And we'll hear first from Mr. Hens, and you may proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. Brenton Hens on behalf of Appellant Kimberly Ann. So I'd like to just proceed right to the heart of the matter, which I believe is the issue of qualified immunity here, and specifically whether the law was clearly established. So I would agree that the law is not clearly established, and that the officer in this case would be entitled to qualified immunity if my client was actively resisting and if the officer's use of force was indeed trivial. The problem with...
But the video shows she says no, no, and reaches back. She stretches her body out back towards the counter that's behind her. That's not active resistance?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I've seen that video about 50 times. I don't see her reaching back. The time frame that we're talking about is about 1 second from when the officer...
There's clearly a frame where her arm is out and she's leaning.
We're talking about what amounts to like a reflexive movement from when the officer goes up to her. He reaches in without any sort of a warning, without telling her that she's under arrest, and they all admit that they didn't order her out. And my position is that that video creates a dispute of fact. It's not clearly contradictory to her testimony. And so on that issue, it appears that you agree with the court
that
it clearly...
I'm asking you a question. Because there is... I mean, I could print it out and show you a frame where she's leaning, the arm is out, reaching into the room, and then she also says no, no. And so you're saying that that's consistent with a finding of only passive resistance, and I'm asking you to explain why you believe that's true.
The passive resistance comes from the fact that she's never ordered out. She's never told that she's under arrest. And under Nelson...
But once he grabs her arm and pulls, she knows at that point he wants her to come out. And at that point, does she actively resist or passively resist?
Respectfully, Your Honor, at that point, she doesn't know anything. Something has happened very suddenly. We're talking about like about 1 second, 1.5 seconds from when he puts her arm on her to when her face collides.
But the two things she does is say no, no, and reach the arm back into the room.
She says no, yes. I don't see her reaching back. What I see is like a reflexive movement of when somebody who she didn't know is, you know, that she wasn't anticipating came in and grabbed her suddenly. And so if we're talking about
you could just think the arm went up as part of the pull and it wasn't actually reaching towards the counter.
Right. Not reaching toward a counter, not attempting to flee. And a jury could look at that video and they could reach a different conclusion from the district court. They could reach a different conclusion from the officers. They could reach a different conclusion from me. But it's their prerogative to make that determination.
I want to understand, you know, where you started your argument. As I understand it, if you think there's no triable issue as to passive resistance and that no reasonable jury could conclude other than that she was actively resisting, then qualified immunity would apply.
If she was actively resisting, if the jury concludes that, yes, qualified immunity. If the jury concludes that the use of force was trivial, qualified immunity. Those, I believe, are reasonable concessions in the context of this case. The fact is, the problem is, those come down to factual disputes. And what the Supreme Court has said...
So do you judge the reasonableness of the force by the nature of the force itself or by the consequences of the force?
Well, it's both, Your Honor. So if we're talking about, something that the physical contact, right, a shove or a push or a tackle, you can't really separate that from the consequences, the injuries that result. If you look at the Rice versus Morehouse case, you see in that case, the plaintiff was just tripped and they suffered, you know, grievous facial injuries. And then, you have the Blankenhorn case where he was gang tackled and, you know, you didn't have lifelong injuries, but those were deemed to be significant uses of force above the level of trivial. Trivial would be something like, okay, like a push or something like that. Even if it's not necessary, I think a court could reasonably say, okay, that's de minimis. But if you're talking about something where somebody suffered injuries, the result of the injury of the use of force and the force itself, you do have to view them together under the totality of the circumstances. Yes.
Let me ask you, with respect to qualified immunity and cutting to the chase with respect to whether or not there's precedent that made the lawfulness of this action beyond debate that would have informed the officer that what he was doing was wrong. What case do you cite for the proposition that this was clearly established?
Rice versus Morehouse would be the most recent one, 2022. We have somebody who is at most passively non-compliant. I believe that I briefed that case, but also the Blankenhorn case. There's another case that we didn't, well, we cited it, but we didn't sort of expound upon it, but that's the Andrews versus Henderson case from 2022. Those are all examples of this.
And walk me through Rice. What was the nature of the force that was used in Rice?
So the individual had refused to get out of the car, and they pulled him out of the car, and when they're walking him away, they trip him, and he hits the ground.
Boom to the ground.
Right. Right.
And so here, although your client asserts that she was thrown to the ground, you assert that she was pulled to the ground, correct?
Pulled into the doorframe. This is what the video shows.
I think I saw somewhere where there was some reference to pulled to the ground. So then you don't claim that then she was pulled to the ground?
She ended up on the ground. Pulls her, face hits the doorframe, she's on the ground.
So to the extent that she wasn't pulled to the ground but merely ended up on the ground, isn't that then distinguishing itself from Rice?
No, Your Honor, that would be an immaterial distinction. So what the circuit precedent holds is that just because an officer happens to find a novel method of inflicting injury, that doesn't create a material distinction for purposes of clearly established law. If it's enough to put a reasonable officer on notice in those circumstances, then that's sufficient for qualified immunity.
Could a reasonable jury, if you're tripping a person to put them prone on the ground, your intention is that their body will have contact with the ground. Do you think a reasonable trier of fact here could find that when he grabbed her, it was his intention to slam her into the doorframe?
They could possibly find that, but it's the fact that her face hit the doorframe. So you're asking, does he have to intend it, and could the jury, if the jury finds that he intends it? I don't believe the jury needs to find that. They could. But
but if you want to have qualified immunity that it's clearly established, an intentionally slamming someone, knowingly making contact with the ground, is different from pulling someone's arm and fortuitously she slams into the doorframe, which, unless you think there's some evidence that he intended that.
If an officer intentionally breaks the law, qualified immunity protects all those who are incompetent or who knowingly violate the law. But that doesn't mean that. If he did something that was, unreasonable under those circumstances, and it happened to result in injuries to her face, that by the way, was the situation in Rice.
So
there was no requirement. Yes.
So I want to make sure that I understand what your argument is. Does your argument depend on her hitting her face on the door jamb? If she doesn't know that she's under arrest and he has reached into her apartment where she's standing in her own apartment and forcibly grabs her arm and pulls her up, but she doesn't hit the door frame, does she have a Fourth Amendment claim here, or an Eighth Amendment claim?
Perhaps not, because as I argued,
the damages certainly wouldn't be as great.
Right.
But if your argument depends on the fact that she doesn't know that she's under arrest and that the officer has forcibly grabbed her with two arms and pulled her, then that would be simple assault if it wasn't an officer, right? That would be an assault.
Right. I want to make sure I understand what you're
saying. Yeah, I'm trying to figure out whether her hitting the door jamb is actually important here, because Judge Collins says there doesn't appear to be any evidence that he intended to slam her into the door frame, as opposed to Rice, where they deliberately trip the man who's gotten out of his car.
In Rice, they deliberately tripped him, but they didn't intend for his face to hit the ground.
Well, they didn't intend for his face to hit the ground, but that
wasn't hard
to figure out that he was going to hit the ground.
No, of course not. But in this case, if the officer pulls her, he intends that she's going to wrench in the direction that he's pulling
her.
Okay,
but I'm just trying to figure out whether your argument actually depends on her hitting her face on the door jamb. You may not have damages. It may not be worth bringing the case. But if he's grabbed her and she doesn't know that she's under arrest, then is that a violation of the Fourth or Eighth Amendments?
If she doesn't know that she's under arrest.
If an officer simply grabs her, what if he didn't have probable cause at all? What if the boyfriend wasn't even on the premises?
If you didn't have probable cause at all, that would be a far different situation. In this case, we can see that there is probable cause. I want to get back to your first question: is how does her face hitting the door jamb change the is it material to the case? The answer is yes. You can't separate the injury suffered from a use of force from the use of force itself. If an officer punches somebody, and so one person doesn't get brain damage, the other person does, you can infer that that use of force under those circumstances must have been more severe for the person who got brain damage. You can't just say that, well, as a matter of law, every instance of pulling or every punch or every trip, those are all this level of force. You do have to evaluate it in light of the injuries that are suffered. And in this case, the injuries to her face do indicate that it was a non-trivial use of force.
So I just want to make sure that I understand the sort of the framework of California law here. Under California law, did the officer have to arrest her because there had been a claim that she pushed the boyfriend?
No, the officer's not required to arrest her. The law says that they need to make reasonable efforts to ascertain the dominant aggressor. And just to clear things up, we're not disputing the issue of probable cause here and that the officer could have arrested her. That's a concession that we're making. It's the manner in which he did it. The manner in which, you know, without warning, without telling her she's under arrest, without ordering her out, without any indication that she was violent or armed or anything like that, just spontaneously grabs her and her face hits the door jamb. Under those circumstances, that is not a reasonable use of force. The probable cause issue, that's not something that we've disputed. And so I don't want those two issues to get mixed together. But were there any questions pending that I left hanging? If not, I'd like to reserve the rest of
All
my
right.
time.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.
We'll hear next from Mr. Tyson.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Robert Tyson from the Anaheim City Attorney's Office on behalf of the appellees. We're focused today on the excessive force part of this case, which is solely against Officer Belshin.
Why didn't the officer just say, Ms. Ann, you are under arrest and I'm ordering you to step out? I mean, why not just say you're under arrest, step out, rather than just grab in and do what was done? It would have been much simpler. We all wouldn't be here, perhaps.
Well, Your Honor, they tried a version of that.
They said, you know, I need you to come out. I don't want to come out. Yeah, but your cat's already got out. I'm not worried about the cat. Well, we have your cat. I mean, this is like it's like pleading with her to come out.
Yes.
And there isn't a clear order. I'm ordering you to come out. Get out here right now. They didn't even say it in that kind of tone, like get out here, stand right here. Instead, it's just this sort of conversational pleading and then grab her arm and then she's flung into the doorframe.
Belshin hasn't said a word to her at this point. He's been down the hall with the boyfriend. We've got the other two officers who have been conversing with her.
Yes.
And the last thing she's heard that orally has been from the other officers. Belshin's never said a word to her.
Well, actually, he says, we have your cat.
Oh, we have your cat. Okay.
But literally the last word said by any officer before he steps in is him saying, no, we have your cat around the corner, responding to her argument about my dogs and cats. She declines for the third time since Officer Belshin's been standing there to come out.
Let me ask
so
you,
he steps
did she
in.
Have an obligation to come out? She was in her home, correct?
She's standing in her open doorway, Your Honor. Her body is holding that doorway open. We cited United
but
States.
But he had made a decision to arrest her. He'd given the signal that she was going to be arrested. Yes. Just say, you're under arrest, step out. Give some order that's clearer.
Let me try it this way, Your Honor. That would be an option available to an officer in that situation. He comes down the hall. He's got probable cause to arrest her. They've done a little communication by hand signals between the officers. She's the one that's going to be arrested. They have probable cause. The officers invite her out twice. The second time is a little more forceful. Maybe don't want to go it's all the way that it's an order, but it's Officer Julianne saying, I need you to come out. She declines a second time. There's an exchange about the animals. Officer Belshin pipes in, we've got your cat down around the corner. She refuses a third time. She's standing with her back. She's in the open doorway where they can arrest her, but she's at the back edge of that door by the handle. She's a half step from fleeing inside. So Officer Belshi, at this point, she's refused three times to come out. They have probable cause to arrest her. She's in a spot where he can arrest her. He steps in.
Does she know that they have probable cause to arrest her?
Well, I think it's interesting, Your Honor. We pointed out in the brief that she predicted about 2 minutes before her arrest that Mr. Martinez would be trying to turn this around on her. So I think it's a fair argument that she predicted her arrest.
If the officers didn't have probable cause and Belshi just got irritated that she wouldn't come out and just reached in and pulled her?
Well, then
do you lose your qualified immunity if the boyfriend has not told Belshi that he touched her?
Well, Your Honor, we haven't briefed arrests without probable cause in this case because it was undisputed that the officers had probable cause.
I'm asking you the hypothetical. If we had the exact same thing, but there wasn't probable cause to arrest her, then what?
Then he'd be making an argument about detaining her or something along those lines based on whatever the other facts are that are changed in that situation, I'm guessing, Your Honor. But if he didn't have probable cause, there's no indication here that without the probable cause, Officer Belshi is making that step in. There's just none. And I think...
Right, but I have to say this is a very, very frustrating case because she is the one who called in. She's the one who's concerned that she's going to be assaulted by the boyfriend during what's going to be a very tense day while he's moving out. They know that she's the one who's made the 9/11, the non-emergency call. She is standing in her own apartment, and now an officer, all of a sudden, without any warning, without any explanation, without any demand or information that she is under arrest, reaches in and grabs her. This is utterly reflexive. What is resistant on her part is she doesn't want to be grabbed by somebody for reasons that she has no idea why she's being grabbed. She hasn't even been given the option of coming out because she is under arrest.
And Your Honor, I can correct a couple things. I think there's a couple things in that statement that I disagree with somewhat. Yes, she made the call to the police dispatch in the morning. And she seemed to be making the call trying to have her boyfriend arrested for cheating on her. That's the conversation she seems to try to have with the police dispatcher. And then the police dispatcher hears when Mr. Martinez wakes up, appellant get absolutely enraged because she thinks she calls him the wrong name. And she is arguing loudly with him for four straight minutes to the point that the 911 dispatcher has to remind her that she is still on the phone with the police. She was clearly in that audio conversation the dominant aggressor that we hear about in Penal Code 13701.
Did any of these officers hear that call?
No, but Officer Belshi referenced it to Mr. Martinez because the dispatchers relayed that information that a 415 was heard. The loud noises, the big argument between the two of them was heard. That is related to the officers, and Mr. Belshi brings it up with Mr. Martinez. So the officers are aware that there was a loud argument that morning, and they're open to whoever was the aggressor. And the only evidence is she hit him. That's the only evidence. She does not dispute that he did not hit her. She repeats it on the phone call to the dispatcher. She tells the officers at the doorway. She tells the officers after the fact, sitting on the curb when she's arrested, that he did not hit her that day.
So reviewing this under the Graham analysis,
yes,
there's no question that the appellant did not pose an immediate threat to the officers, correct?
No, she didn't pose an immediate threat to the officers.
He was calm and when she was speaking with the officers, correct?
In general terms, yes. Grab my water, go ahead, Your Honor.
And in terms of the idea of resisting arrest, she was never told she was under arrest in order to even be, viewed as resisting arrest, was she?
She wasn't told she was under arrest. Officers aren't required to tell them that people are under arrest when they go to physically grab them. That's nice in some cases, courts have said, but they have refrained from requiring it in every case for obvious reasons. And one of the reasons is what could have happened here. Like I said, she's in her open doorway holding that body open, but she's a half step from fleeing inside.
Fleeing inside her own apartment. The term fleeing inside just seems utter overkill in this situation. She's standing in her own apartment. She might take a step back.
And then the door shuts, and that's the flight that would be needed.
And then what?
And then officers either have to follow her in there, which they're allowed to do under Santana, and possibly lead to more force and doing things like you've talked about, like counsel's talked about in Blankenhorn and Rice, which didn't happen here, like throwing her to the ground, physically arresting her, taking out a taser. Who knows what she would have done if she did flee inside? There were animals in there. There was a kitchen right there visible that Officer Belshi is concerned in the minute few seconds where force is actually used here that she was reaching out for. So those are all things that could have happened. Now, this officer is standing there in the moment. He's got probable cause to arrest this person. She's standing in a spot where he is legally entitled to arrest her. And all he has to do is pull her a couple of feet out into the hallway where his colleagues are, and they can safely have enough room to arrest her. And that is all he starts off to try to do. And that's important to understand here, Your Honor. You can see him step in with both hands out like that. She turns and steps away. She describes it as stepping back. She describes it as leaning away. She agreed in her deposition testimony she tried to pull to get out of his grasp. She leaves him to grab just one arm, unfortunately, instead of from both sides that he approached her. And in the middle of this, he's got a split second to decide what to do at that point. Do I let her flee inside and let go? Do I just try to pull a little bit harder? He pulls just a little bit harder. She's out in the hallway. This use of force lasts 2 seconds. If you count the whole time when he even first took that step in, feels her resistance, makes the adjustment, which you can see on video, him leaning down and pulling back on video.
So
it's all 5 seconds, but it's 2 seconds of force, and he does get her, use just enough to get her in the hallway, and then they get her handcuffs. The only issue in this case is that her face hit the doorframe because she was off balance from her resistance.
One of the things that was argued by opposing counsel was the idea that there wasn't any affirmative resistance. It was passive, and that her reaction was just a reflex, and that this is something that should have been left to the jury. What's your response to that?
My response to that is twofold. Is one, threefold. One, it's on video. She wasn't passive. She stepped, she leaned, she reached out. The reach is only one aspect of her resistance. She leans back. You can see a step on Officer Belshi's video, and he got the reach out. Two, she admits all those things. Those are physical acts of resistance.
But is it resistance or is it like reflex? Somebody in the moment is pulling you and you don't wish to be pulled outside of your home.
And that's the third part of my response, Your Honor. Graham, in every case since, has been absolutely clear. You have to judge the reasonableness of the force from the perspective of a reasonable police officer. It's fine. That's reflexive from her perspective. From the officer, what he sees is, I'm trying to gently bring her out here, and now she's pulling away. From his perspective, the physical acts that she admitted to are resisting. And it's a split-second decision, split-second use of force, and except for hitting the doorframe on the way out, it's effective because he uses it only for a second or two. She's in the hallway. They get her handcuffed. There's no objection to anything that happens after she comes in the hallway. This is just a split second.
So you just disagree with opposing counsel as to whether or not this was something that the jury should have been entitled to decide?
Oh, I absolutely disagree. This entire event is on video. It's a few seconds of reasonable force overcoming a few seconds of resistance. I absolutely agree. I don't think there's any issue to go to the jury here.
But we would have to view that video in the light most favorable to Ann.
You have to view the video in the light most favorable to Ann, but you have to judge the reasonableness of the force from the perspective of a reasonable police officer on the scene. And if you do that, and you put yourself in Officer Belshi's shoes, you've got a woman who's a half step from fleeing. Yes, it's a short flight, Your Honor, but fleeing nevertheless. inside a closed door.
The worst that she could have done would have been to close the door, and he's standing right there, could easily just stick his foot in the door.
Well, he could have, and they could have, per Santana, they could have followed
but
her
sticking
in.
His foot in the door would prevent the door from being closed. Yeah. But at some point, the officers need to tell her what's going on here.
Your Honor, I'd point to, there's a case called Seidner, cited in the papers. And that was a case where they used, officers ended up using a vehicle to stop a bicyclist on a bicycle. But what the opinion points out midway through it is that the officers clearly communicated, and maybe it was more of a moped or mini bike of some sort, but the officers clearly communicated in several different ways and steps that they wanted that cyclist to stop. An officer pulled over and approached him on foot and was trying to talk to him, and the guy sped by. They set up a roadblock. That didn't stop him. And there was something else. There were three things inside him that those officers clearly communicated their desire for that bicyclist to stop, and he never did. In this case, the officers clearly communicated their desire to get her in the hallway. Once there was the little tap on the wrist between the officers and the communication, and they're all on the same page that she's the only one who assaulted anybody, that they're going to arrest her, Officer Julianne immediately invites her out into the hall. And then a second time, she says, actually, I need you to come out in the hall.
And what is she supposed to understand by being invited into the hall?
She's supposed to understand that police officers are telling her they want her in the hallway.
Yep. Okay, but for what?
Your Honor,
is she supposed to understand that means that she's under arrest if she's in the hallway?
Your Honor, I think it probably does tell her that, and I think it tells her that in a friendly, non-confrontational way. It's these officers telling her, "We're about to arrest you, but we're trying not to make you more angry." When you're in this spot where you're a half step from fleeing, the officers can use reasonable force at that spot. They can arrest her there. The few seconds of Officer Belshi's force here were reasonable, and he had to make a split-second adjustment in the middle of it. And I don't think the court would do anything different if you were in his shoes.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear rebuttal.
So Appellee's counsel talked about some of the concerns he involved the words possibly, or the phrase of what the officer might have to do. And I'd just like to point out that those concerns are hypothetical and speculative. I'm talking just about what the officers did, what happened in the moment. And I'm not trying to second guess what the officers did. I know it's a very difficult job, but under these circumstances, it was unreasonable. And if you look at that video, there's a factual dispute about he's saying that it shows her fleeing. It does not show her fleeing. A jury could find otherwise. And same thing with her reaching for allegedly a weapon. And I urge the court, take a look at the Supreme Court's case, Tolan versus Cotton from 2014, one of the very few times that the Supreme Court has vacated an award of qualified immunity in recent years. And so it was an excessive force case. And basically, in that case, what the district court did is it resolved all the factual disputes in favor of the officers. And the Supreme Court intervened in a very, very rare circumstance to correct that error. And that's what appellees are asking the court to do here. They're asking to resolve factual disputes that should go to a jury. Now, a jury could find one way or the other. That's their prerogative, though. That's not and I understand that a video. Now that we have video evidence, it's very tempting. People can watch it, make up their own minds, but this court should resist that temptation. If something, unless something is clearly contradicted by the testimony, you have to let the jury decide what the video shows. So this is not a situation where she said it was up, but the video shows that it was down, or she said that it was red, but it was actually blue. We're talking about something that involves a lot of facts, a lot of factors going into it, bearing on the reasonableness of the officer's actions, and it should be the jury, not a court, making those decisions as to those factual determinations. And backing up to qualified immunity, if the court finds that she was not actively resisting and that the force was non-trivial, that brings us within those clearly established cases that I mentioned before. And that's why I had said at the outset that if those facts are found to be true, that she was actively resisting and that the force was non-trivial, then they might be entitled to qualified immunity. But otherwise, the law is clearly established.
So the Supreme Court in Rivas Villegas v. Corluna gave guidance to this court with respect to what is clearly established. And it required, if not a pairing, a matching that I'm concerned that we don't have here between this case and the Rice case. And so could you address the Supreme
Court? It is a very high bar, but what the Supreme Court has said is that you don't need a case on all fours. What it has to be is it has to be apparent in light of pre-existing law. And what this case has held, what this court has held repeatedly in light of the cases that I mentioned in other circumstances, similar circumstances, is that the law is clearly established. It doesn't have to address every discrete use of force in every possible scenario in order to put the officer on notice. So my position is that it is specific enough.
All right.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. The case just argued will be submitted.